shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The Talk of the Town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra. Bedtime turns me off and I don't need maybe.
9 to 5 ain't taking me where I'm bound. Welcome to this edition of Nocturnal Journal on WGN from the Allstate Showcase Studio. We've got a show tonight with David Chris a little bit later in our Polynesian Hour to talk about the Lowbrow Aloha at Hala Kahiki on April 2nd. The second segment of the show will be the great Frank Catalano in studio playing saxophone solos and talking about his illustrious career. And our first guest is the biggest expert on Easter Island that I know of, Dr. Joanne Van Tilburg. How are you doing, Joanne?
I'm fine, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I went to Easter Island last November. There's a lot of reasons to go. It's a place of beauty, as you know, mystery, love, wonder. And for me, it was kind of a spiritual resurrection. Tell the listeners who don't know anything about Easter Island about it. I know your first visit there was 1982.
1982 was the first time I went, although I had wanted to go for most of my childhood, I think, or my middle school years. I've been thinking about it, and it receded from me a bit, and then I had an opportunity in 1981-82 to visit it as part of an archaeological project. And so, yeah, what do you want to know about it? It's small. It's remote. It is isolated in many ways. It lies midway between the coast of South America and Tahiti in French Polynesia.
One reason, before I went, I heard it was the most isolated island in the world. Is that true? What about Antarctica? How isolated is it?
Well, I like to think of it as more remote than isolated, because today it's not isolated much at all, as you know. It's very much in contact with the rest of the world. So I think it's quite remote, and of course, when it was settled, it was certainly isolated.
You wrote a book called Among Stone Giants, The Life of Catherine Rutledge and Her Remarkable Expedition to Easter Island. There's a passage in here.
I'm guilty. I did it.
It says, the rolling grass-covered hills of Easter Island, the breaking surf and endless sky entranced Catherine. In the deep mists of time, she said, great lights and flowing lava must have gleamed across the expanse of water, then gradually lessened and died away, leaving their work to be molded by the wind and tide. Tell us about Catherine and how you related to her in your work as an archaeologist.
Well, you know, she was an interesting person to me from the very beginning, from absolutely the first time I set on Easter Island. I was very, very enthralled with the fact that she had not only been there very early, which was 1914, but she came prepared to actually, I think, try to discover something new. She had an ambition. She had a curiosity. She just seemed like a wonderful person to me, someone I wanted to know. And so as time passed and as I worked on the island myself, I found that I was retracing in many, many ways her original path of discovery. And that was engaging. So when I went to do more research on her actual life and her work and her personal journey to get to Easter Island, it was more enthralling than I ever dreamed it would be, because she was a woman faced with incredible challenges in her life, including a nascent mental illness. So I admire her. I'm intrigued by her. I'm currently actually investigating and excavating in the same area where she worked. So all in all, she's been a wonderful companion in the field to me, to be honest.
What'd you learn from her that you apply today?
I think what I learned from her more than anything was to keep an open mind. And I think she linked quite and connected, I suppose is a better word, quite intimately with the Rapa Nui people, and she was willing to ask questions that hadn't been asked before. So I think more than anything, it taught me to listen more than preach to people.
You say in your book you didn't find out about her mental illness till toward the end. It was 1992 and stuff. You found some notes.
Mm-hmm, I did. I was doing some work at the Royal Geographical Society, and when she had at some point in her life, her family, specifically her husband, had delivered all of her field notes and journals and miscellaneous papers and just dumped them into a white tin trunk that she had taken with her on the voyage to Easter Island and took them to the Royal Geographical Society. And this would have been, you know, more or less at the very beginning of the Second World War. So in his defense, I think he was trying to protect her papers and trying to preserve them. But they were in complete disarray. It was just a mess. And as I was going through them and opening notebooks and field books and so on, I saw the names of Rapa Nui, the ancestors of Rapa Nui people whom I know personally. And so that got me going, and I began to go through some of the papers. And at one point then, a torn piece of paper fell out of a notebook, and it was a clue to what she had been struggling with, which, as I said, was nascent mental illness. She actually had auditory hallucinations. She heard voices. And in a way, that was helpful to her because she had to quiet, in many ways, her responses to people. She had to listen carefully. And she also had to find ways to control these kinds of problems that she had. And she did it. She did it brilliantly. And she was a superb observer.
You said she worked with Juan Tapano, and Juan Tapano is a great-grandfather, the man with whom you work, right? You said
That's
it felt
correct.
Like something that was meant to be. I mean, so you learned stuff through history, oral histories?
Well, you know, so many of the Rapa Nui people who were alive when Catherine Routledge was there, they were the last really informed people whose families and had lived through a tremendous amount of tragedy, you know, with what's called blackbirding in the Pacific, which is slave trading and that sort of thing. So the island itself had suffered enormously. And when Catherine was there in 1914, she was, I think, the last person to talk to people who had experienced with their own consciousness, their own sensibility, the old culture. So the people with whom I work are very enculturated into the Chilean way of life, as well as, of course, as you probably saw when you were there, Rapa Nui attracts people from all over the world. So Rapa Nui people are very cosmopolitan people. They speak many languages. They're very modern in the way they look at the world. And so I think I didn't learn in the same way she did, but because of the fact that I do work closely with the community and that I work with the descendants of the families who worked with her, I think I do gain some insight. But of course, it's not going to be as vitally connected to the community and its history as it was in 1914.
I think it's, yeah, I read stuff. I read some guidebooks. I did some research before I went there, and people said things were written that it was kind of a sleepy place and there wasn't a lot to do there. But if I had known there was much going on, I would have stayed longer and stuff. There were good restaurants. There were a couple floor shows, like tourist floor shows. The tourism thing was a little more developed than I thought it would be. I mean, we'll get to the statues at Statue Head Zamoya in a little bit, but it's changed a lot since tell us how it's changed since 1982, just the way of life on the island.
Well, in 1982, when I traveled there, I flew from Santiago. I flew from Los Angeles to Santiago, Chile, and then from there to the island. And in those days, there were so few tourists who were actually going to the island that we had to wait, I recall, maybe 2 or 3 days in Santiago to get a flight full enough to go to go to the island. And so once there, the island was, of course, there were few people there than there are now. But also, I think, for example, I had to borrow a Jeep from the local priest because there was no car to rent. Most people traveled from one part of the island to another on horseback. and there were no or few modern conveniences such as television, or, you know, you certainly couldn't phone the mainland as you can today. Mm-hmm. So it was more tranquil in lots of ways, but I'm not one of those people who look back on that and think that was a better time. I think that was hard for Rapa Nui people in general. It was certainly hard for me because I couldn't contact my family very easily. I had to do so by ham radio through the local priest. So it felt more remote and more isolated then than it does now.
Now, the pedestrian perception of Easter Island are the statues and the Moai. So explain that. I know we only have a little bit of time, but talk about those. And I think it was real fascinating. You told me a few weeks ago that it's not over until it's over. Right now, you say there are 887 statues on Rapa Nui and 90. Well, and I know where some of them were started, built. But tell us about them and how they're constructed, where they are.
They're carved of stone. It's a consolidated volcanic ash. All but a few, maybe 30 of them, were carved in the same volcanic quarry area. They're heads and torsos. And I think I told you, Dave, but when we published pictures of our excavations, we had something like 80 million hits on our website to the point where it crashed, because some sort of communication went literally around the world saying, my goodness, Easter Island statues have bodies. But the truth of the matter is that when Catherine Routledge excavated in 1914, she demonstrated that the so-called heads on the slopes of the quarry were in fact heads and torsos. So the statues are truncated at the waist. They have no legs, per se, at all. There may be a couple of them that look like they might have incipient legs. In other words, they were beginning to think about carving in that way. But in all of the statues, basically, are truncated at the waist, have no legs, have their arms tightly against their sides of their bodies, and they're quite passive-looking when you see them.
We're going to take a break for a spot here, but before we do that, it's the Easter Island Statue Project. That's where that website is, right?
That's where it is.
And give me the website, and then we'll talk about that, your project, in a little bit. But give us the website while we're on that train of thought.
Okay. It's www.EISP, for Easter Island Statue Project, .org.
Okay, don't go away. We'll be back with more after this.
Okay.
So the Rapa Nui, the local indigenous tribe, I got word that the chief was like a fan. And then from Joanne Bontilli that, you know, they wanted me to come and, like, when they do their cultural festival, be a guest, and they would let me sing amongst the statues. I was headed there to figure this thing out to see if it was actually true or not when I fell off the stage in Australia, because I was going to go from there to Moorea, and I was going to fly back through Easter Island on my plane and go check it out. So I've never been able to do it. Now, I'm going again in, like, April of 16. I want to go because I got to get there.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. That was our friend Jimmy Buffett, who finally made it to Easter Island, right, Dr. Van Tilburg?
Indeed he did.
Okay. That wasn't too long ago, right?
No, actually, it was just about a week ago.
Okay, and what happened? What did he do? What questions did he have? I know he's a smart guy, so.
He's a smart guy, yeah. That's for sure. Yeah. And he's a poet, and he's an artist. And the questions he had were related to really a lot of the idea of the mystery of Easter Island. But to be honest with you, the best interchange he and I had when we were there together really was when I asked him a question about what he, as an artist and a poet and a singer, would attribute this energy, this desire to not only carve a statue, but carve almost 1,000 statues.
Yeah.
And that was just incredible to me. So it was interesting, and I think it really comes down to not only just the expression of an idea in a culture, but to the motivation, the energy, and the desire of artists to make their mark. And so we had a fabulous time. was wonderful.
So did he pick up on that? How did he respond to that? That's a great observation.
Well, it was more his observation than mine. Uh-huh. I mean, it was really, and I think what he wanted to do was not overwhelm the island with his persona, with his, you know, fame in many ways, but he was very kind and very generous and very giving to the people. And so he sat and got to do what he wanted to do, which was sing to the statues. It was astonishing.
You told me earlier this week, I was kind of doing a pre-interview thing, but I've been there, and there's not a lot of beaches, but you guys, pick up the story. You guys went to the one beach area. Describe the beach area for the listeners, and then what happened when you guys went there.
It's a crescent-shaped beach that's palm-fringed, and it's unique on Rapa Nui because Rapa Nui is a volcanic island. It has very high rocky cliffs. There aren't very many beaches, and most of them, if you find them, are pocket beaches. They're small. But this is a grand beach, and in fact, this is the beach that Rapa Nui legends say was fit for a king. This is the beach that the original settlement party arrived to when they came from wherever they were on another island prior to settling Easter Island. So it's a dream beach. And Jimmy had seen a photograph of it in my office here in Los Angeles and fell in love with it. And so once there, it also has a majestic restored site with beautiful statues on it. So it's very, very special. And the part that was so nice about it was that it wasn't a big production. It was simply Jimmy singing to the statues as he wanted to do. And I think that it was a perfect sign of respect on his part to the culture of the Rapa Nui people, but also it was the perfect setting for some of those lovely, lovely songs he's written.
And then you said some Japanese tourists came by?
Yes. So we're all sitting around, and there are, you know, some elders there. There were some of the most respected elder Rapa Nui women who were there, decked out with beautiful hats and flowers, and some pretty young girls who could sing, and a couple of fellows with ukuleles. But it was a small, small group, very informal. And suddenly a very large group of Japanese tourists gathered around, and they were taking pictures and so on. But they clearly didn't seem to me anyway at the time, know who he was. They were just listening and watching, and I'm not sure whether they were Japanese or Chinese. But in any case, at the end of one of his songs, a lady walked up and gave him a tip. And he was so happy and excited about it.
The last question, we're going to take a break for the news. Did he talk about coming back and maybe doing a concert for the locals and stuff?
You know, I think he might be thinking that, but he didn't. He sort of discussed the possibility, but I sure don't know what he plans to do.
Sure. You're going to be in the Nocturnal Journal Hall of Fame. You're such a great guest. So can you hang on for about another 15 minutes after the news?
Sure.
Okay, we'll be back after the news with David Jennings on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. We're here with Dr. Joanne Van Tilburg, director of the Easter Island Statue Project, director of the UCLA Rock Art Archive, an author, fan of Jimmy Buffett and Hunter Thompson, and that's some local music I picked up when I was there. Do you know much about the indigenous music there?
You know, I wish I knew more about it. I love it. There is nothing that we know about ancient music on Rapa Nui, and they didn't have stringed instruments of any kind. So what I've seen when they're working with some of the cultural groups on the island and thinking and talking about how music might have been made in the old days, they think it was mostly percussion, you know, pounding beating on their bodies with their hands or on rocks. And then there is some evidence that there were drums that were made in the ground, actually, so that you could stand on a plate of stone on one of these concavities, jump up and down on it in time and create echoing sounds. So there must have been a lot of percussion that they were doing.
Yeah, you know, when I checked into my hotel, they were playing that type of music. It sounded a lot like Zydeco, like a little bit of that snippet we played there. It had that Zydeco feel to it. It was very, very interesting.
Does. They actually like things like the accordion because it's an island, and in the early days when the ships would come, most of the big ships that came had some sort of music aboard. In other words, someone with a fiddle or with an accordion or some way to entertain the crew. And so these fellows would always demonstrate what they could do, and Rapa Nui people love the accordion, or most of the young people do anyway, and fiddles and guitars.
One of the great mysteries is how the statues were moved. So what's your take on how the statues got around, left the quarry?
I think Rapa Nui people are very bright, and I think that they tried lots of different things for whatever would work for a given statue depending on its size. I think they rafted some of them around the coast. I think they moved many of them up to about maybe 10 meters tall on roads. We have paved roads that are that have curbstones and so on that go in different places in the island. Actually, Catherine Routledge mapped all of them. And the University of Chile teams who worked there in the 80s, they mapped some of them. So how do they move the statues over the roads? There are two theories about it that are primary most of the time. In the last 5 or 6 or 10 years, we've been talking about two possibilities. Rapa Nui oral traditions say the statues walked. They say that on the basis of a metaphor that has to do with the movement of the statues around at night, because the statues, of course, are metaphysical objects. They're ghostly figures. And so they have this concept of these objects as having the power themselves, which is called mana in Polynesia, of moving on their own. But Rapa Nui people also know that the statues, A, don't have legs, never could have actually walked. So how could they have been moved in that upright position? So various people, beginning with Thor Heyerdahl, have demonstrated the possibility that you could rock a statue back and forth and move it short distances over flat ground. But in fact, Rapa Nui is not flat, and there are lots of hills and valleys and areas in which statues would have had to be moved in a horizontal position. So we also, in our excavations, have discovered the fact that there are these deep pits, concavities, that are cut in bedrock. So the statues were raised and moved inside the quarry anyway, using ropes and upright posts and probably rollers as well. So there's a lot of evidence. We're trying to piece it together, but there is no specific way that you could say that all statues were moved in that way. They were moved, I think, depending, again, on their size and the distance that they needed to move the statue.
How can people tell us a little bit about Easter Island Statue Project, how people can find out more about this? I know you lead tours. Tell us how people can get more involved. I mean, I want to go back. I got to save some money, but I mean, I want to spend more time there. It really is truly a fascinating place. Like I told you, I needed a place just to get away and kind of get a sense of rebirth. Actually, as long as we're talking about that, how did it get the name Easter Island?
It got the name Easter Island because it was discovered in 1722 on Easter Sunday by a Dutch fleet of three ships, and so they named it in honor of the day.
And tell us about your website then, and how people can, what you do and what the project does.
Right. So my project is directed, as you kindly said, by me, but it's co-directed by a Rapa Nui artist and surveyor who's born and raised on Easter Island, about whom we spoke earlier, the descendant of Juan Tepano. And also we work almost exclusively with the Rapa Nui community. So all of the people who excavate, the whole team, they're Rapa Nui people. We also work with students, Rapa Nui students, who are being educated on the mainland, who are interested in their own culture. But we do bring people from young people, students. We also bring volunteers at different times, depending on their skills. So we're very broad-based. We have a very big net. We throw it a long way, and we try to capture people who can help us to see things in a new way, help us to make new discoveries, help us to do the work we do. Our main issue right now is preservation and conservation. So we work with experts in those fields. The Rapa Nui people are very concerned, as I'm sure you learned, about the preservation of their statues.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
It's very, very important because the ash, the consolidated ash out of which the statues are carved, that's very friable. And some of the statues are kind of melting like sugar cubes in the rain out there. So it's very important to preserve the statues, and the Rapa Nui people are very concerned about that. And they're deeply involved in talking with lots of different people about how to do that. In our case, we have a pilot project. We've worked with conservation people in Chile and here in the United States, and we're treating up to about 18 statues in the next year, and then probably we'll move forward with the project and work on maybe another 50. Not all statues can be saved. Some are too far gone. But the beautiful ones that you saw, the ones that Jimmy sang in front of, the ones that are in the quarry, for example, these can be saved. And we need lots of help with that. So your listeners and anyone interested in Easter Island should go to our website. They can contact me very easily or anyone on the project. Our email addresses are all there. And I can't promise anything to anyone at this point in terms of actually going to Easter Island. But I've had many different people in different professions who have volunteered at different times, and they've all been helpful. So we're carrying on. We're committed to this project, and we're grateful for the opportunity that the Rapa Nui people have given us to do the work we do.
We have a full story on the website that will come up with the podcast. It's at DaveHoekstra.com, where we have more about what you do and stuff. But the last question before we have to wrap it up is, I think it was really fascinating the way you say people's attention spans have changed over the years since when you first went. So my question to you is, how should people, and I would have asked you this if I had, you know, even found you when I was looking for you on the island, but how should people approach a maiden voyage to Easter Island the very first time? What do they need to bring with them just in terms of where their head is at? No pun intended.
It was a good one.
Yeah, I just thought of that.
It was a really good one. Yeah. That should go on your website.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. What they need to do is they need to bring with them a profound respect for the fact that they are being allowed to visit a sacred site. The entire island is sacred to Rapa Nui people. The land on which they live and the land on which their ancestors built these magnificent platforms and erected these statues, it's a sacred place. And so they need to bring that profound respect with them. Once they bring that respect, then they will find, I think, that their curiosity will be rewarded. But they should also prepare themselves. They should do some reading in advance in order to really appreciate what it is they're seeing. I think it's an honor to be able to go there, but if you can do some reading, check some websites, read what you've written, read what I've written, read what other people have been there, have said, I think that they'll get a sense of the adventure of the place. That's really important. It's a tremendous adventure to see the Rapa Nui.
You're the best. You're just so fun to talk to. You're easy to talk to. You know what I mean?
Well, so are you.
Make everything plain spoken and stuff. So thank you, Dr. Joanne Van Tilburg on Easter Island. And travel safe. Next, when are you going there again?
In November.
Okay. All right. Thank you again. We're going to take a break here for some commercials, and we'll be back with David Chris and Aloha Takiki. Our Polynesian Hour continues here with David Chris, my good friend. How come all the people in the tiki world are called Dave and David and all that?
It's a popular tiki name.
So, Dave, you're a designer and an artist, and you're behind the first ever Lowbrow Aloha Saturday, April 2nd, noon to 5 p.m. at Hala Kahiki, which may be my favorite tiki place in Chicago. So
classic.
Tell us what this is about.
It is a sort of like a pop-up art show sort of a thing, and what it is it's an opportunity for local artists that are of the tiki enthusiast persuasion to come together and display their wares and their art and stuff for sale to the public using the Hala Kahiki as a vintage tiki backdrop that kind of adds to it.
And how many I see here, tell us where people can find out about it on a Facebook page.
Yes. If you go to Facebook and look up Lowbrow Aloha, you will find the event page and all the information's listed there.
And how many vendors, roughly, do you think there'll be?
Roughly 14 vendors. Roughly 14 vendors.
And I know I've been to the one at Chin's in Detroit. I went a couple. That was in the winter, I think. I remember snowing outside.
Yep, yep,
yeah. So absolutely. Tell us what happens at these things. I think you also mentioned the international marketplace at Don the Beachcomber and stuff.
Yeah, the Chin's Tiki Show has been running basically like 9 years, and it's usually around the holidays. They like feature it as like a gift show sort of a thing. And it's basically the same concept. It's held in a vintage tiki bar. The bar and restaurant is open so people can go in and just order food and drink and stuff. And then half of it is dedicated to vendors, artists, tiki carvers, painters, what have you. And that was I was kind of involved with that show. I was a vendor there for a couple of years when they were starting out. And it was kind of the inspiration because I always wanted to do something like that here in the Midwest, like in Chicago, that's more local and stuff. And the opportunity presented itself through the owners of Halakahiki. And so we decided to run with it and give it a try. And hopefully it'll be a success.
So you'll have painters, jewelry. What type of stuff can people expect?
There'll be jewelry. There'll be painting. There'll be some vintage collectibles available. There'll be some carvings and whatnot. It's a really good collection of artists and craftspeople from around the area.
I think people from Dan and our favorite publication, Bachelor Pad, will be there.
That's right.
Right? I've
yes,
seen them.
Bachelor
I've seen
Pad
them.
Magazine will be there. They are one of our vendors.
They have. Yeah, that's great. They're out of Central Illinois or something.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, tell us. I know your history with Halakahiki goes way back. Tell us about how you first came into the Halakahiki.
Well, being a tiki enthusiast, I kind of found my way there eventually, and I became friends with the owners. And being an artist and a designer, I wound up designing some of their table lighting for them. And selling some of my stuff out of their gift shop, some of my crafts and lighting and whatnot. And we just developed a great relationship over the years, and it's just been one of my favorite places to go to. It's in the Midwest. It's one of the last of the great original vintage tiki temples, and they've done a stellar job of just keeping the whole thing, you know, keeping the vintage, you know, aspect of it intact and actually, you know, and while at the same time making it relevant and, you know, current.
Yeah. You were saying, I saw you there a couple of weeks ago, it has a great sense of history. You feel that when you go in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The place is, it's kind of timeless. It hasn't changed that much over the years. And even if you talk to older folks that have gone, that used to go there back, like, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, I mean, not a lot has changed too much. I mean, it's you know, for the most part, it's true to form with a few revisions and remodel things here and there, but it's basically intact, which is cool.
And are you helping them? There's going to be some designs in the bar area, redesigns?
Yeah, there's going to be some renovations and stuff coming in the future. They've got some other ideas for some things they want to do a little expansion on and whatnot. So we're kicking some things around. But look for things like that to happen over the course of this year.
How'd you get into the whole tiki culture and stuff? What was your influence?
You know, I think it's just, you know, my parents took us on road trips and vacations and stuff to Florida when we were kids. And I just remember, you know, going to crazy places like the Castaways in Miami and like tiki bars, roadside type of stuff. You know, it just kind of stuck with me. And then years later, as I became an adult, it kind of, the nostalgia, I think, kind of came back to me. And I just kind of started to get back involved with it. It just kind of drew me in. There was no real conscious decision. It was just kind of like a feeling like, you know, this is really, you know, it reminds me of like home. It reminds me of, you know, it's that nostalgia that kind of drew me back into it. And it was right about the time of the Tiki Revival that was happening in the mid-90s. So
we've talked about that on the show before. The Tiki Revival in Chicago kind of goes up and ebbs and flows,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Yeah.
I think there's kind of one now, but, you know, Trader Vic's didn't make it here, you know,
yeah,
once they moved out of the Palmer House. Yeah.
Exactly. There's always like a core, seems to be like a core subculture of this stuff, but then it comes in and out of fashion really fast, you know. It's kind of a real quick, it's in and then it's out and then it's in, and it happens in the space of just a few short years usually, but there's always this undercurrent of folks that have been into this for some time that, you know, I've always just kind of supported the local tiki scene.
You're so modest about your design. Tell us about what you do for your design. And I know you do stuff around your house and stuff.
Yeah.
The Elvis Tiki, remember that?
Creative, yes.
Yeah, tell us about the Elvis. That was like a few years ago.
Yeah. The Elvis Tiki, that was
that's it.
Yeah, it was a collaboration between myself and artist Cindy Crowell out of Texas at the time. It was based on one of her cartoon characters, and I kind of joined forces with her to actually make it a three-dimensional reality in the form of a resin, hand-painted and crafted resin character that we did a short run of those a number of years ago. But yeah, those were a big hit. People like those.
And you guys decorate you have your house all fixed up?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, we got theme rooms. You know, we're mostly like 50s and 60s atomic and mid-century type stuff, but more leaning more towards the kitschy side as opposed to the streamlined modern. But our whole attic space is a giant tiki room, tiki bar filled with all kinds of things tiki.
The money question here is, how'd you find a woman who let you get away with all that? Well, she's in the studio with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, I got to be careful.
We don't allow kids in the studio, but we allow wives.
Yeah, no, she's real supportive. She's really supportive yeah. of it. And, you know, she's, you know, again, it's, you know, we're about the same age. So, again, it's that nostalgia thing. I think it just kind of touches upon certain people that, you know, something inside clicks and you're just kind of, you know, certain things feel right. So you kind of get drawn to, like, she's a big fan of, like of course, like vintage, like Art Deco and stuff like that. And, you know.
I've seen you guys at LaGrange. What's that place in LaGrange? They have the resale place, the antique mall.
Jackson Square. Oh, the place is wonderful. Yeah, it's great. It's a great local antique mall. Lots of vendors, lots of booths and stuff. And, you know, we usually never come out of there empty-handed.
Yeah. So give us the rundown again. Lowbrow Aloha.
Lowbrow Aloha.
Okay. And the date?
And it is April 2nd. And it is from noon until 5 p.m. It's a Saturday. And that is at Hala Kihiki in River Grove.
Is it harder to find? We just mentioned the antique mall. Does stuff get picked over and stuff? I remember talking to you years ago. You could go into the gift shop at Hala Kihiki and maybe see a Witco thing in the back.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's gone. The stuff is gone now. How hard is it to find like stuff like – tell us what Witco is and how hard it is to find.
Witco is a – Witco-style carving. Well, Hala Kihiki is loaded with it. It's a dark wood, dark modernist – abstract type of tiki style,
the jungle room
carvings. Yeah,
the
Elvis's jungle room is a perfect example. Yeah. That's all Witco type of carvings. But yeah, like years ago, you can find this stuff in the gift shop. You know, it's like before the whole tiki revival, that stuff was readily available at most places. For example, you go to the Kahiki that was in Columbus, Ohio, and you can buy their salt and pepper shakers, and they still had them in the boxes. Behind the counter, it was crazy. And then, you know, the tiki craze, you know, hit, and then it was just, people were just buying that stuff up, and then it was all gone, and that was the end of it.
We got to wrap it up, but I wonder, eBay's probably hurt that a little bit, right? I mean,
eBay's what?
eBay? I mean, you can get just stuff off of eBay now.
Some of it, yeah. Again, the prices fluctuate. I mean, things spike, and then they level off. It really depends. When you're a collector like myself, I've been collecting for so long that now it's just come down to the few rare holy grail type things that I'm looking for, because we've got so much stuff from over the years that, you know, most of what I see on eBay is, you know, it's like, okay, got that, you know.
Well, this is a great thing you're doing. So one more time, noon to 5 p.m., April 2nd at the Hala Kahiki, 2834 River Road in River Grove.
Absolutely.
So thank
Hope
you guys.
See you folks there.